Please be seated. Good morning. We have three rules hearings today. And we welcome you all. Cameron, as you said, you're going to have to pay rent here. We'll start with 0902 in the matter of the petition to amend Supreme Court Rule 7201 regarding record retention. The presenter is Judge James Kiefer of the Waukesha County Circuit Court. Judge Kiefer.
Good morning, Chief Justice Abramson, Justice Bradley, Justice Crooks, Justice Prosser, Justice Rogenczak, Justice Ziegler, and Justice Gableman. Before I begin,
got us all.
Okay, that's all seven.
Do that again, please.
But in reverse order, with your eyes closed. I reckon his introduction.
You do it better than I do, Judge.
Before I begin, I just wanted to tell you, Justice Crooks, that upon further review, the Packers still lost that game yesterday. Ferocious here. So, anyway, again, good morning to all of you. Thank you for the opportunity to present this petition seeking to amend Supreme Court Rule 72.01 relating to record retention. In March of 2006, the Wisconsin Circuit Court Access Oversight Committee issued its final report wherein it recommended that the Supreme Court comprehensively review Supreme Court Rule 72.01 so as to provide a record retention policy for Wisconsin Circuit Court access case records that would be clear, consistent, predictable, and easily understood. A records management retention subcommittee was formed, and the petition presented today is the result of several meetings that were held to address this recommendation. Now, I know from my discussions with Julie Rich that all of you have gotten the paperwork here, and this is a highly technical petition here, and there was a lot of work that went into this, but if you have specific questions regarding some of these items, I'd be more than willing to, hopefully to the best of my ability, address why we did what we did do. But if not, there are just a couple comments that I would like to bring to your attention that I have found through my analysis and my review after the petition was filed that somehow did not find their way into the petition or might have just been inadvertently overlooked.
Okay, you're going to give us section number and subsection.
Would, yes, okay. I would. The first section that I'd like to refer you to would be under 72.01, parent 15, and this also relates to parent 16 and parent 17.
Just hold one second. Would, we've got various versions, and the version I'm going to look at is the one that the Legislative Reference Bureau made.
Correct, and that's the reason why I was going to comment on that,
okay.
Chief.
And that would be under Courts tab 5, page 3, the blue pages. All right. All papers deposited with the clerk of circuit. You don't object to putting in circuit, do you?
No, that wasn't. I think if you go on to the next page, which would be
in proceedings
on
commenced.
Four. Correct.
As felonies, do you object to any of that so far?
No.
So you would strike the words that were stricken.
What I think the copy that you have, Chief, is fine, but the petition that was filed had right before where it says for Class A felonies, 75.
Okay, I'm going to now look at your petition. That's going to be, I think, under tab 4 and 7201-15. Is that where we're at?
Chief,
it's going to be at 14.
I think tab 4 is the comments of the LRB. That's my understanding.
It's tab 1. Tab 1 has got the petition.
Yep.
Okay. That's fine. That will be 7201-15 is at page 13. All right.
Mr. Haisley of the Legislative Reference Bureau put the word except prior to the words for Class A felonies. And when our committee met, we did not put that specific word except before that phrase. And after I've thought about this and analyzed this, I think that if you keep the word except that's in that petition, in the original petitioner, it really doesn't make any sense. The intent of our committee was to say that in most felony actions, the longest that you're going to be retaining the record would be 50 years after the entry of final judgment. If you have a Class A felony, we wanted it to retain for 75 years. So it's my belief, by using the word except, it changes the entire meaning of what our committee came up with.
This would be true not only in 7201.15, but also 7201.16. Is that correct? Your comments go to both, or am I incorrect?
Correct, Justice, and sub 17. Mr. Haseley had used that word in those three sections. He used the word except in front of each and every one of those entries, and I think that just changes the entire.
And sub 17.
Excuse me, I stand corrected. You're correct on that, Justice. He did not put that word in there on sub 17, which I don't know why he didn't, but he did on 15 and 16. My request is just to delete the word except in 15 and 16 and leave it how it is in 17 so it flows all the way through. Then it's consistent.
Tell me what's wrong with putting the word except in there.
Well, I hope that I've analyzed this correctly, Justice, but it seems by using the word except, I'm not certain what he's trying to refer to on that here. Our intent, again, was to say if you have a Class A felony, keep the records for 75 years. Well, if I've analyzed that incorrectly, then so be it, but it just didn't seem to me to be proper to use that specific word.
What you're trying to, here it reads now, a brief statement of in-court proceedings commenced as felonies. I want to read the way you want it, Judge Kiefer, as felonies generally maintained in the case file, colon. Is that right? 50 years after entry of final judgment, semicolon.
Right.
Class A felony, 75 years after entry of final judgment. That's the way you want it.
Right.
Well, I have to tell you that when the LRB is not supposed to make any substantive changes, they're not interested in that. But when they start making changes that look to you like substantive, it means to me that an outside reader was confused, interpreted this, and made language changes to fit their interpretation of the language. So what their objection is this. You have a flat rule that says 50 years after entry of final judgment. But then you have an exception. Except for Class A felonies, where you retain the records until 75 years of entry of judges. That's what you intend?
That's right.
Right. And that's what their objection is. Their objection is that they don't see how 50 and 75 hang together because 50 covers everything and then you are making an exception for Class A felonies. So this is not just a language issue. It's, to me, an issue that someone who read this was unclear about your meaning. So the important thing is to try and figure out what you intend, and then have the draft do it. So what they did, that's why they put in except 50 years after entry of judgment, a final judgment for all judgments except for Class A felonies, which should the records should be held for 75 years. That's what you intend.
And that makes sense then, Chief, but
Okay.
As I read this over and over again, I guess I was on the opposite side, but that makes sense. Then if that's the case, then under 17, then you need to add the word except.
Well, then, yeah, I've got the same issue in 16, where a history and index commenced as felonies, retained 50 years of entry of final judgment, except that Class A felonies, you keep them 75 years.
Right.
And now in 17, a brief statement of in-court proceedings commenced as felonies, 50 years, because these are all kept, somewhat different records kept in somewhat different offices. That's the point of
right.
these three, if I understood it. Commences generally maintained 50 years after entry of final judgment, again, except for this. So may I say to you that that kind of technical drafting to get it clear can be handled as long as we all agree that felonies are kept 75 years, all other felonies 50.
Correct. The Class A felonies you keep for 75 years, everything
right.
else 50 years.
Right. Correct. And that goes for 15, 16, and 17.
Correct.
Okay. All right. But other than that, you accept the changes of the LRB, which say commenced, just in these three sections. So, commenced as felonies, eliminate including minute records regarding the commitment in 17.
Correct.
You accept all that.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. The next section that I wanted to bring to everyone's attention would be 72.01, parent 33.
Just a minute. I just have to make a note, okay?
Deals with guardianship court records.
What's the provision again? I'm sorry, Judge.
Parent 33.
33 of 72.01. Okay. Let's look at that. This is guardianship. Deals with 33 and 34.
This is just on 33 that I wanted to bring to your attention, one item.
Okay, just one second. All right.
What was deleted from here is the phrase 7 years after termination of guardianship. This was, I don't know how, did not find its way into the petition. It should say under 72.01, parent 33, parent A, history and index for adult guardianship proceedings commenced under chapters 54 and 55 stats, colon, and then what was deleted was the following 7 years after termination of guardianship.
That's a little more complicated.
That was just missed.
Pardon me?
That was just missed.
Right. Which exactly are you talking about? 720133, what?
Parent A.
Parent A. Okay. And what do you want it to read as?
Right after the word stats.
Just a minute. Meaning statutes. Right. That's at the end of A.
Correct.
Okay.
And then there should be a colon, and it should read 7 years after termination of guardianship.
That's the time period which was left out.
Correct.
Okay. I have a question for you under 33 and 34. It says chapters 54 and 55. The next one it says 48 and 54. The next one says 54 and 55. I didn't go back to look at those statutes. You don't have to bring them under both, do you? It's either or
right.
both. When you do a chapter 48, do you have to automatically do a chapter 54? I'm questioning the word and. It sounds as if it has to come under both at the same time.
I don't believe so.
And I thought maybe the word or in all three of those provisions was, in all four of those provisions was correct.
But Chapter 48 is the Juvenile Justice Code, and that's what provides for guardianships. But then I think the actual procedure for guardianships for both juveniles and adults is contained in Chapter 54. So I think that's the reason why the committee had those two chapters listed there.
Okay, well, I just have a question whether you want and or there.
It's been a long time since I handled those, so I'm shooting from the cuff here on that.
And I never have, so we're in dangerous territories.
I'm a slow learner here. 7201-33B, that's what you're talking about?
The one before that, Justice, it would be under sub A.
Oh.
It would be 72.01 parent 33 parent A that I was saying that phrase was missing, the 7 years after termination of guardianship.
In your original petition, you don't have A and B.
Not. Mr. Haisley came up with that.
You don't object to that?
No, I think it's a good idea.
And what you're doing is he just separated out adult and juvenile guardianships. Okay.
Correct. That's what he did do.
Right.
Could you read then precisely what you want in A and B of subsection 33?
It's just under, Justice, it's just under sub A. I'm not asking for any changes under B. It should say a history and index for adult guardianship proceedings commence under chapters 54 and 55 stats, colon, 7 years after termination of guardianship.
So 880 is out?
Well, we did that because that was the former statutory section, and that statute is no longer in existence. I know that Mr. Haisley brought up, I think, an excellent point by saying there were guardianships that were commenced under chapter 880. And I don't know how you do that when you have a new statutory chapter versus the old one, but there were prior ones commenced under Chapter 880.
So you left in 880.
Well, I think we deleted it, but I think he was suggesting putting it back in or at least making some reference
to
it.
What do you want to do?
I think that there should be some reference to the past because those are records that are still in existence.
Include 880 then.
Correct.
It's 54 and 55 and 880 stats colon.
Correct. Again, Chapter 880 is no longer in existence. That was replaced by Chapter 54.
When it was divided into two provisions, what was lost in A was a statement of how long they should be retained.
Correct.
Which is the same same period as in B, so juvenile and adult guardianship are retained the same time.
Right.
Okay.
Judge Kiefer, do you know if in extradition matters there's a retention policy, how that works?
Justice, I have no idea.
I was wondering if there was anything in here. You know, they happen every now and then, but they're not everyday type things. You know, who has to keep the record or...
I'm trying to think at least in my county, when those proceedings are commenced, they are always commenced as felony actions because you would not be extraditing misdemeanor offenses. So I think that the retention period would go back to whatever any felony would be other than a Class A felony.
Makes sense. Okay.
There's no reference to Chapter 55 in subsection or paragraph B?
Correct, and I don't know how to answer that, Justice, why we did that. I don't know how to answer that for you.
And 7 years after the juvenile's 18th birthday is different from 7 years after termination of the guardianship? That's perfectly fine?
It is. It is.
Okay.
And the Legislative Reference Bureau has suggested 880 in 32A, 32B, you have no objection to that.
And I
33A, 33B, 34A, 34B. And suggested a reference to 879 and 31.
Chapter 880. 880, correct. Yes. And I would agree with his request.
One of the problems of cross-referencing to the statutes, which we have to do, is that they change in numbers. I mean, not instantly and not every year, but periodically, and that makes it difficult, which is why you're putting in 880.
True. To deal with things that had gone on in the past.
Do I understand, then, that 880, which had been deleted by the committee, is now going to go back in?
That was the suggestion of Mr. Haseley, Justice Bradley, and that makes sense, just because this change over to Chapter 54 occurred within, I think, the last 2 years or so, maybe 3 years, and there's a lot of those cases that are still out there from Chapter 880 from the past that there are records, so this makes perfect sense.
What do we do, then, with his suggestion that if it's going to stay in, if not to be removed, the statute drafting style is to show the statute book when the statute last existed, that is, Chapter 880, 2003 stats. Now, I'm not going to do that. What's your that is, I'm not going to sit there and write this in, and I'm not. What's your understanding of the process that not only will 880 be put back in, but someone then will do the 2003 stats? Who does that? Do you have any idea?
Cool. I wish I knew that. In fact, I didn't even know Mr. Haseley even reviewed these types of petitions, and I found that out a couple weeks ago when he came with these specific changes here. Mm-hmm. We did not think of that when we were just more or less looking forward rather than kind of going in the backward, because there are some of these changes that we are asking to delete certain rules that no longer exist, and there isn't any possibility of all of any of these records being retained because of the passage of time. This is one of those that there are, I think, a significant number of Chapter 880 proceedings that are still out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Judge Kiefer, have you had a chance to review the memo given to us by Commissioner Rich?
Was this relative?
This is October 20th, I think, is the date.
I did not. I've talked to Ms. Rich several weeks ago. Actually, I just met Ms. Rich today here. I was in Nevada 2 weeks ago going to school, and she and I carried on long-distance phone calls at very odd hours.
The reason I'm asking you that is because she details some areas where there were questions in terms of what the LRB brought forth. And then she's got reflected the committee's recommendations. So, in other words, those were worked out between the two of you long distance, basically.
Correct.
Thank you.
Correct.
I have some concern, since this is such a technical petition. For instance, what we were just talking about and what Justice Prosser was making reference to, 720133. In that, there are a couple, sub A. Just take sub A. Right now, it looks to me like in 720133, you take sub A and 880 will be put back in, then we will add, and then someone will add, anytime there's a reference to 880, 2003 before the word stats, or I'm not sure how that's going to be worded, because it's 880, 2003 of the statutes kept in the, I'm not sure how much of what was deleted by the LRB is going to go back in, but I do know in 720133A that we are going to add, as pursuant to your request, 7 years after termination of guardianship. With regard to B, I heard Justice Prosser asked,
why don't we have Chapter 55 referenced there in B like we did in A? And maybe I misunderstood the answer, but what I heard was that we really don't know. Did I misunderstand the answer?
I believe I've just been handed a note from probably Ms. Ward Cassidy. I suspect the answer, and I acknowledge I don't handle these types of matters, so this is somewhat new ground for me. Juvenile guardianships are under Chapter 48 and 54 and not under 55. So I think
that's the answer to that question. So it appropriately should not be in 720133. But it should be in 720133A.
Correct.
That's adults. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. You called our attention to 720133 to 34, you called our attention to 720115. What's up next?
Two final matters. Under sub 42, which deals with juvenile delinquency matters.
Okay, let's just all find that. 42, juvenile delinquency. Okay, got it.
2.01, parent 42. Now, the petition that I was given has Mr. Haisley put in the word except with a question mark after it, except 75 years after the adjudication of the juvenile or child. I think the memo that you have from Ms. Rich does not have that word except before the number 75.
We do have a word except. Just a minute. Let's just look at your original petition, 720142. All right. Except as provided in sub 24, all papers this is your original petition, deposited with the clerk of circuit court, register in probate, or clerk of court for juvenile matters in proceedings commenced under 48 or 938 stats, 4 years after the 18th birthday of the juvenile child, 75 years after the adjudication of the juvenile or child if he or she was delinquent, etc. All right?
And the paperwork that I have says right before the number 75, there is in parentheses the word except question, and then there's a question mark. Mr. Haisley had put that in there, and I'm not certain why he had that in there. In the memo that you have from Ms. Rich, she does not have that word except in there. I'm not suggesting that the word except should be in there.
Since I didn't see that is, it wasn't called as a change, I'm wondering if it's the same problem as in the first issue you stated. So ordinarily, papers deposited for juvenile matters, the general rule is 4 years after the 18th birthday. And then you see you've got, that's your general rule. And you have an exception for a juvenile adjudicated delinquent committing an act that would be punishable as any felony. So if the child had been adjudicated as a delinquent for a felony, you got to keep those records 75 years. But the general rule is 4. So I think that's what your problem is.
Right. And it's the same issue that we
Same issue as you had before. So it's a question of redrafting this. You're not happy with the word except. Doesn't make sense to you. They're not happy with not having anything. So it's just a matter of getting it drafted so it is stated that the general rule is, but for this particular class, it's 75 years.
Right.
That's your intent.
Right.
Okay. Judge, do you have any problem with the number 75 that was inserted by the LRB after the word except in 7201 parentheses 42?
Actually,
That's their original.
I think that's what we had come up with in our own meetings here, Justice Bradley. And we did that because in adult felony cases, you have a retention time of either 50 or 75 years. And so we, as the committee, just simply said, just for ease of reference to all the clerks, just make it 75 years in these types of matters, rather than having a rule of 50 and a rule of 75. So that came from our committee.
That's your change. You see, we have some difficulty in recognizing at all times in our materials what's your change and what's the LRB, which is why you're getting some of these questions.
Let me, on that same 720142, it's my understanding that the issue was brought to our attention with regard to the words clerk of court for juvenile matters, and the question whether or not that was a correct term. And as I understand the differences between the LRB and the committee, is the LRB asks, as is indicated in their response, whether or not that is a correct term. And do I understand correctly that it is the committee's position that it should stay as drafted?
Correct. There are many different counties, Justice. You know, I don't remember how things were, you know, in Marathon County, but there are some counties that have a clerk of court, and then there's some that also have a register and probate, and some that have a clerk of juvenile court, and some are mixed, and they're joined together. They have two but not three. So just to be consistent throughout, we kept in all three.
Is there, if you know, such a thing statutorily as a clerk of juvenile court? I know there certainly used to be, you know, in the good old days, that were not always so good, but in the good old days, there used to be a separate clerk for juvenile court, I think statutorily. But I don't know if there is now.
I don't know. And I know that when we discussed this, that the committee members, which consisted of a lot of different backgrounds, they said keep all three terms.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Could I ask, in this subsection 42, is that consistent with subsection 15?
As to the retention time, Justice Bradley? It is. There are two different retention periods under felony for adult felony cases. It's normally 50 years for entry of final judgment, 75 years for Class A felonies, for instance, first-degree intentional homicide, those types of felonies. So we had those two different levels under the felony case records. The committee, when we met on this, just dealing with juveniles, we just decided to lump them all together.
Well,
you
explained that. Well, let me just give you a hypothetical. Let's suppose we have a Bonnie and Clyde situation. I'm Clyde.
I'm Bonnie.
She's Bonnie. We commit a robbery together. I'm 20. She's 17. You're going to keep my records for 50 years. You're going to keep her record 75 years if she's convicted as a juvenile. Is that right?
That's the way it's drafted. Again, it was for ease of reference within the clerks. But if under your example, Justice Riley was 17, she'd be an adult anyway, so that wouldn't be a juvenile issue. Now,
16.
If she was 16, that might be different here. But
sweet 16.
Correct. That's the rationale behind
why?
It.
Well, 15. All right.
He's longer, and you're not, so.
Are you offended, Bonnie?
No, Clyde. That's okay with me.
which provision was renumbered here?
Is 41 still 41?
I believe the termination of parental rights matter, which in the petition is 72.01, parent 42M. I believe that's the one that was renumbered, if I remember correctly. The old rule had the termination of parental rights retention period in between, I think, two or three different entries on juvenile records.
Then the juvenile court records.
We wanted just to take it out of there so all the juvenile records would all be together.
Got it. The memo that we received from Commissioner Rich indicates, with regard to issue number 8, under, you were talking about 7201 sub 42, that the LRB does not want this renumbered, and the committee feels strongly that renumbering is appropriate. What's that issue about, if you know?
I think, again, because of how it was originally sandwiched in the juvenile records, we just thought it would more consistently flow if it had had a different number rather than under the sub 42 numbers. Frankly, as I considered what Mr. Haisley was saying, that's fine. It really doesn't make any difference.
Professional drafters, as a rule, general rule, don't like renumbering because then it's hard to track it. And if there are provisions elsewhere that refer to it, we're not picking them up. And so they just prefer, if at all possible, to retain numbering. That's why things are put in as 6M. That leaves room later to add A through whatever precedes M. And leave room for whatever succeeds M in the alphabet. And so that is a technical drafting. Substantively, you dislike having a fugitive section in there that separates others, but you're not going to the mat on it, I assume.
In fact, that's what Mr. Haisley did under the sexual offenders records, which we didn't even get into. We came up with new rules as they related to Chapter 980 proceedings. And he did that numbering, M and R,
right,
and G. And
right, in order to avoid in the future what we're talking about. Let's see if there are other issues here that we should be talking about. You have no objection to including in subs 11 through 14 a reference to paternity judgments?
No, that was suggested by an attorney, a local attorney from my county, who is with, I know he's on the board of directors of the family law section. That was just an oversight by our committee.
All right.
We needed that inserted in there.
What about the DOR and 7201-78? That the DOR thinks that maybe that was not in compliance with the statutes.
Which section again?
7201-7A. The note here is the DOR has some issues about it. These legislative changes have created three different time periods for which these warrants are considered valid. As such, a retention rule outlining three different periods is needed. Maybe we just have to hold that, or at least put that on a schedule for examination.
And I'm not picking up on your chief.
Yeah, I don't think it's 7A either. It's on page 8 of your petition, and maybe that just substantively has to be looked at, Judge Kiefer. It is the substantive issue from DOR.
What's the subject matter, Chief, that you're dealing with in 7A? Because I'm not seeing a 7A.
Oh, 7A deals with delinquent income or franchise tax warrants and dockets. It's on page 8 of your of the petition.
Yeah, it's been changed to 7M in the Legislative Reference Bureau's draft, which is on page 8 of their draft.
So I've been trying to use the petition and the blue sheets at the same time.
Okay.
And
well, it's changed on the blue sheet too. It's 7M. It's at the bottom of page 1.
If I think I can answer that question for you here. We did talk about that. We created this new section. It's under 7A. Thank you, Justice Rogenczyk. And the notes that we had from our proceedings said that the Department of Revenue notified us that our current retention rule did not comply with Wisconsin statutes,
right.
And there were various time limits that applied with this versus this, and that's the reason why we came up with this rule.
Pardon me?
We came up with 72.01 parent 7A.
I know, but it seems to me that maybe I have it. Is that your final word, or was that changed by the DOR? Did you change it in accordance with what the DOR said?
Actually, I think maybe some of the confusion here, just with the numbering system here, for 7A, I think in the petition it's under 7M, and I think Mr. Haisley changed that. So
okay, I understand that 7A is now renumbered 7M. Is that in compliance with the Department of Revenue?
Correct. This came from them here, and to my knowledge, they are in agreement with this.
Okay. All right. We did receive a letter of interest from the Family Law Section Legislative Committee. The letter is dated August 21, 2009, and signed by Anthony Menting. Did you get a copy of that?
I did, Justice.
If any, is the response to their concern that the section, subsections do not contain any specific reference to paternity judgments?
We agree with his request here. I did not talk about that at the beginning because it was my understanding that language dealing with paternity judgments was going to be inserted into this petition here. We agree with it.
Thank you.
We agree with it as to the retention period as it relates to keeping these records for normally 30 years. If these cases are dismissed, we don't want to have the reference. We don't want a dismissal of a judgment of paternity. From what I've been told, child support doesn't want that. And why? I can't tell you exactly here, but we agree that it should be added here. That's a huge component of family law work anyways.
All right. I'm trying to look at our notes to see if Ms. Rich or anyone else has raised an issue. I think covered the issues that we have. Now, what about 720150?
That section dealing with trust account ledgers,
right.
I will admit our committee never, ever talked about that, and I don't believe that we came up with any suggested changes on that.
Well, I think their only change is putting in circuit for circuit court.
True. I stand corrected. And that we made throughout all of the rules to make it
you
consistent.
You don't object to that.
But I know Mr. Haisley raised some question about that, and our committee never, ever talked about that at all.
Do you remember what questions he raised?
Let's see.
I'm trying to find his notes quickly.
Yeah, I think he thought it needed to be reworded, that it was inconsistent in form with the rest of the subsections. So
That's correct, Justice Rogenczak.
Correct, but I don't understand what the form, what the issue is.
Well, it doesn't flow consistently from a grammar perspective like some of these. But again, we never talked about this, so we never revisited this to try to tinker with it to make it consistent. If it could be reworded in some fashion, so be it. But otherwise, we were not asking for any changes on that.
Okay. When I was preparing for this, I wrote, ask, consistent with what? Explain. Do you have any idea what they were referring to? The LRB asks that 720150 trust account ledgers, that the provision be reworded for consistency. Consistency with what? Do you know? The other subsections have a statement of the record and then an express time period. This one says to keep it for the same time period as the case file is. So they don't give a special one. They relate back. Then they have another provision. When the trust account is closed, the record may be filed with the related trust account file, which doesn't sound like a retention provision as expressed elsewhere, but I would suggest we not fool with this because it hasn't been looked at and we don't want to change it without some express direction to change and in what way. But that's the problem. That's what he sees as a problem. It looks odd. And if you just, your eye just runs down the page, it looks odd.
When we talked about all these rules, as I said, we never really got onto this rule that much here. But even when we were kind of in this area, no one raised any objections or comments to this here, so it didn't attract our attention.
Are there any other questions? Judge Kiefer, I've sat through more hours than I care to remember or relate with the retention record provisions of the court's own records. And this is such detailed work. And the retention of one record brings on a related record. And concept of whether the records in certain areas are sufficiently the same, that you should use the same rather than a different time period. And then, of course, all time periods are arbitrary. I mean, 74 is as good as 75 or 76. So I want to, on behalf of the court, say thank you to you and the committee for working on these very important issues.
Well, thank you for those very nice words, Chief. I had a lot of great
people. And not sexy.
Yeah, that's true. That's an understatement. I had one other rule that I wanted to bring to your attention before, and this was deleted from the actual petition itself here. It was such an unbelievable topic dealing with ministers' credentials. The blue memo that I believe that you received from Ms. Rich shows it. It's under sub 56, minister's credentials.
Certification that a person is a member of the clergy, et cetera, retained for 20 years after date of filing. Do you want that deleted?
We do because it really doesn't apply anymore, and there is a kind of a catch-all under Sub 61, Supreme Court Rule 72.01, parent 61.
Sub 61 or another rule? Sub SCR what?
And that section, basically, if any of these things are out there, it would fall under this here. Ministers are no longer required to submit their credentials or file them with the courts here, and apparently there's been some confusion around the state, and since this has been no longer in existence for more than 20 years, we said, let's get rid of it.
What's it covered under now?
Sub 56.
That's gone.
That's our suggestion to the court is to delete it because it really doesn't apply anymore.
because they're no longer required to submit credentials.
Correct.
What about the people who were married 10 years ago? When do they stop having credentials?
I frankly don't know. All I know is that the requirement of ministers submitting here.
Now you know.
Well, see.
Maybe you know.
Okay. The answer is, ministers have not...
I've now forgotten my question. Go ahead.
I feel like Holly Mandel is going to come down here next year. Ministers have not been statutorily required to file credentials with the clerk since 1979. Any documentation left in the clerk's office is now covered by 72.01 parent 61, which is this 20 years after repeal. This is where the records come under. So.
Okay.
Your Honor, do we have the members of the record management retention subcommittee in the event we wanted to name them in our order?
Ms. Ward Cassidy is here, and she was unbelievably great throughout all of our committee meetings here and putting up with myself here. And the other members of the committee are not here, and off the top of my head, it's been a long time since we met here. We started this back, I think, in January of 07. And our last meeting was, I think, almost 2 years ago, and here now. So I wish I had those, Justice Prosser. I left them behind, but they were a great assistance here.
We can get that. Thank you. They should all be thanked, and we'll ask Ms. Rich to send them all a letter thanking them.
But thank you so much for your patience and your questions here today here, and I'm hopeful that I'll have another opportunity in the future maybe to come back and see all of you again here. But again, thank you, and it's nice seeing all of you again then.
Judge Kiefer, there may be remaining technical issues that Ms. Rich and the court will need to finalize this, so we may have to be back to you and the committee.
Fair enough. I'll be more than willing to. So.
Thank you again.
Thank you. It's great to see all of you. Okay.
Thank you.
Bye.
Do we have any other appearances on 0902? Not seeing anyone or hearing anyone, I will now close the hearing on 0902 in the matter of the petition to amend SCR 7201 regarding record retention. We'll move on to 0903 in the matter of the petition to create 88727 stats, 90108, and Supreme Court Rule 70.155 relating to the submission of evidence originating in a language other than English. The presenter is Judge Ralph Ramirez, Waukesha County Circuit Court. Mr. Ramirez.
Good morning, Justices, and thank you for allowing me this opportunity. In addition to being a Waukesha County Circuit Court judge, I'm also the chair of the Court Interpretation Committee, and much of the information that I have about the actions that we're requesting today has to do with my work on that committee, as well as the information I've received from other circuit court judges and persons involved in this issue. What I'm asking is that the court consider a not so radical rule change, a change both to rule and statutory provisions that would assist the circuit court in making determinations about who pays for evidence that is translated. And another issue that I think is part and parcel of this request is the ability for the courts to ensure that non-English speaking litigants or participants in the court process are protected by setting guidelines or standards on the quality of translations for evidence and translations of official court forms, as well as it pertains to the Supreme Court rule and the requested change for the forms. What I also seek to do by presenting this is to request or to create a greater consistency with the requirements that are set out in 887.26 sub 8 regarding depositions of non-English speaking witnesses. That statute pertains to those depositions that were taken out of state, but we don't have that mirror for depositions in state, nor do we have the requirements in regards to translating documents or translating depositions or transcribed information that would allow for the order that I think these rules and these changes call for. I know, obviously, you received the petition, and we have sought and have received comments, written comments from other entities, the Legislative Reference Bureau, the District Attorneys Association, and we've also received some less formal comments from others. But I can only tell you that those comments that you, I believe, received in writing were those which we received in our work and efforts to move this forward. This came about when questions were raised at the trial court level about who is going to pay for the work, the translation.
Let me just interrupt you for a moment. My understanding is that there's not a great, there's no controversy that 887.26.8, which deals with depositions, to just say inside-outside state treated the same. Doesn't seem to be causing any grief.
We haven't heard any grief.
Okay. So that's the only change on 887.26.8 for the moment, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Nor have we heard any grief about the change for SCR 70.155 as to...
That was my next on translations.
Right.
That you created a new sub 5, which says any translation shall be accompanied by an affidavit. The translator knows English and the other language, and in making the translation, translated carefully and truly translated the information from English into the other language, and that the translation is correct. And that's already consistent with the language in 887.26, and so that doesn't seem to be troublesome. Okay, so the comments relate only to, so far, 90108, right?
Correct.
All right.
If I may, if I can anticipate
so
some of
the
questions.
So tell me and tell us, what does the intent here, what is it you want to accomplish here, and what is the criticism thereof?
The intent is to give the circuit court the ability to have a more, I hate to use the word bright line rule, but to have a better basis for making the decision as to who is going to pay for any translations of whether it be a document, a birth certificate, an adoption certificate from a foreign country, a divorce certificate from a foreign country, et cetera.
Well, is it only about money? That's what's bothering me.
No, no, it's not about money.
Okay.
What it's also, in part it is for some people. That's my understanding, especially given the WDAA's comment. But what it's also about is a criticism that at what stage and how do we, most importantly, I think, deal with the situation where there is, for example, a recorded, an audio or audiovisual statement, and somebody wishes to have that put into evidence. Who would pay for that, for example? One, a statement may be taken by a law enforcement officer, and the state, for whatever reason, may not wish to put that into evidence. But if the other side wishes to have that translated and put into evidence, the defense, then this would require that they pay for that. And it clarifies that issue, even if it's a document or an audiovisual recording produced by the police entity. It would require the defense, if they wish to use it, to pay for it, or to ask the court for the ability to do that, because understanding, of course, that just like any other situation where there may be an indigent defendant or an indigent person, courts all the time make those decisions about who might pay for it. An analogy would be, for example, expert witnesses that may be needed, or another analogy may be
investigator
for a public defender case or an indigent case. It happens all the time. The courts do that all the time. Now, the other problem and concern that the WDAA had, and I think it's a valid concern, is what do we mean exactly by evidence that is supposed to be put into, information that's going to become evidence, that is to be used in the court. For example, first of all, let me say that this doesn't in any way change the other rules of evidence, of course, other than what's included internally. But there are those situations, for example, where a police officer at a preliminary hearing may testify about what a defendant said, a statement against his or her penal interests. The concern that they had was that this change would require, prior to putting that into evidence, that there be a translation and that it be provided to all parties. That's not the intent of this. The intent is, if you wish to put in a statement in its entirety or a part of it, the statement itself, then you would assume the costs. Or, for example, a victim's statement at a preliminary hearing, or a child's statement in some type of preliminary, I don't want to use a preliminary hearing in the sense of a criminal case, but a temporary placement decision or something along those lines. The concern that the prosecutorial entity had was that this would prevent them from, at short notice, as such hearings are required to be, putting up a witness who has the ability to say, this is what the person told me. That was a concern. We addressed that concern by looking at the suggested 901.08 and changing, and I discussed this with Mr. Kenny, the deputy DA in Milwaukee County, a party seeking to offer evidence in a language other than English, not using the word originating. And he felt that that was satisfactory from his perspective on behalf of the WDAA. The Legislative Reference Bureau had a question or a comment as to whether we meant only written evidence. No, we do not mean only written evidence. We mean that which may be transcribed from an audio or audiovisual tape or recording, I should say, which may be transcribed. That's not written evidence, but it's going to be changed into a written format by its translation.
Judge Ramirez, is it your belief that this rule would cover the playing of an audiovisual recording in another language, and then in order to comply, you'd have to have that transcribed into a written form in English? Would both of them be presented to the jury, or just the written form?
Well, as to the question, would both be presented, I think that I can see the scenario where both would be presented clearly,
right,
because you may want to see
how they looked and
how
so
they looked.
Right.
Was this person under duress? Was this person pushed?
Yep.
Was
yep.
some one of those things? You can't answer that just by looking at black and white. So
right.
This, in essence, this rule would say, if you wish to present that entire or part of that, then you should have it transcribed, and then you should have it presented or available as evidence as well. The goal may be to present the mood or the demeanor of the person, whether it be a police officer or a defendant in an audio or visual depiction, but this rule would cover that situation.
Yeah, I can see where it would be important to have, particularly if it's audio-visual, I don't know about if it's just an audio, but I can see from the defendant's perspective, you wouldn't want to be limiting yourself. I guess I didn't know why you took out the word originating as I looked at this over the weekend, and instead I would have put in written audio or audio-visual evidence originating and just say what the heck you're talking about.
Well, the concern is because that if we left in the word originating, then it would, I believe, suggest to those who don't have the benefit of being here today, that it means any evidence that comes from a foreign language. that that has to be presented. It has to first be transcribed, first has to be certified or notified. So, for example, if we want a law enforcement officer testifying and the ability to do that, I think it's clear that he or she could testify without first having to transcribe and present that for review by everybody. And again, understanding the time constraints, concerns that some entities, the law enforcement.
I'm not understanding the problem. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
I'm not understanding the problem.
All right.
My understanding when I read this and the notes from our staff and the stuff from the LRB is that there were times when a party would want to present something in a language other than English, and of course the jury's going to hear it in English. That's our rules. So you have to have what you're going to offer in trial to a judge or a jury in an English form. Whether it's also presented in another form, I don't understand what your problem is. I'm sorry. I mean, if it didn't originate in Spanish, or if it didn't originate in French, or if it didn't originate in German, how would we ever use this rule?
It's a concern that I think is a valid concern when, if you look at the, again, this arose from the WDAA comments.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. What we're talking about is information transcribed, then translated into English from Spanish. That's the most common situation.
Right.
But the concern was that, for example, again, the officer who's making a statement who understands Spanish, for example, says, that person told me this. That obviously originates in a different language, but if you...
But they don't want to have to transcribe.
Putting in the statement in its entirety of itself, but a statement made to the officer.
Okay, but if the defendant said, hey, I don't like his characterization of what I said, and this is all on audio, then he would have to have it transcribed and offer it to show that it wasn't an accurate representation by the officer?
Correct.
I gotcha. Thank you very much.
Well, we had a petition quite recently that didn't want to have the reporter transcribe, or report, I should say, any audio or visual, predominantly audio, could be a video, and that they don't have to record it if it's put into evidence. We'll have to look and see if there's any conflict between these two. I don't see it immediately, but we should look at that.
I watched Judge Kremer's over the weekend instead of watching the Packer game.
I don't believe that for a moment.
It might have been more satisfying, actually.
You raise your right hand and repeat after me.
I believe you. I question your judgment, but I believe you.
No, I think it was a wise decision.
In retrospect.
It's the entirety of the Badger game, however.
Seems to me that what Mr. Uggie was objecting to or raising was they'll put on an officer who said he heard this confession and then state what it is, and they don't want to put that confession into the actual audio or visual and to evidence because they don't want to pay for the transcription. And the defense is either going to do it by cross-examination or is going to get a transcript made at its expense. So it's a matter of shifting between two state entities, right?
Yes.
It comes out of the same taxpayers' money, but it's two different entities.
Two different entities, but the same taxpayer money, correct.
Okay. All right. And you think by just changing the word originating carries that?
I believe it does.
And he believes it does.
What's more important is he believes it does.
The question is, no, what's most important is if we believe it does.
Final analysis. One of the other changes is we would add as well, at the end of 901.08, the wonderful term, after the word translation, we'd add a comma, and it would say, unless otherwise ordered by the court.
You agree to change, instead of in cases where, to the word if?
Yeah, correct. And there's two other, on the third, at the end of the third line,
right.
It's where it says, other expense associated with its receipt, and then three lines down, it says English and the other language, and that in making the translation. Hmm. And then...
Rather than such a translation?
Correct. Rather than the, such a translation, it would say the translation. And then in the at the beginning of the last sentence,
what about
saying,
before we
cases,
begin that?
Where?
In the sentence, the translator shall pen to all translations the translator's affidavit, the translator knows English and the other language, and that in making the translation, the translator carefully and truly translated the information. And then your petition has from English into the other language, or from the other language into English, and that the translation is correct. The LRB suggested you don't need the phrase from English into the other language on the theory that it shouldn't be need to translate documents into a language other than English. You disagree. There may be situations like CHIPS orders directed at non-English speaking parents. Is that right?
Yes,
so you want to keep that language in, right?
Yes.
Okay. Just checking. Okay. And then, I'm sorry, you were going on to the last sentence.
I was just saying, Judge, on the last sentence, the it should start, instead of in cases where, it should read if a party objects.
Got it.
And, of course, adding, as I said, the magic words, unless otherwise ordered by the court at the end.
Are there any questions? Justice Prosser.
Judge, when there is discovery in a criminal case, let's say a defendant has given a statement, doesn't that have to be turned over to the defense upon demand?
Yes.
How is it turned over normally?
So if, for example, if there's a statement in a foreign, in a language other than English, then again, usually, as we see it now, it's usually a statement that is recorded by audio or audiovisual means, or at times there will be, for example, a situation where you may have a, and again, I'll use a Spanish-speaking officer may say, this is what he told me, I translated it into English, and then I told the defendant what he wrote, and then he signed it. Well, obviously, that's something that could be subject to cross-examination and challenge, but that is a common way that you see things from time to time in the criminal cases. And, of course, that officer's ability to understand and translate is going to be subject to challenge by the other side, and they may choose then to get their own translator or translation or and or interpreter to do that.
If we had a defendant from the Dominican Republic, and that defendant gives a confession, the confession will be in English?
It could be rendered into English. Again, it could be any number of ways. If recorded, then it could be in the Spanish language. If some circumstances warrant otherwise, in the past, usually, you would see, and certainly probably now and in the future, you could still see situations where it would be written by an officer in the English language who says that he or she understands Spanish and made a correct translation of that statement.
But if they have the disc that is in Spanish, they would turn that disc over.
Absolutely.
As well as probably the other documents.
Both forms, whatever form, they would turn it over, correct. And there would be, in my experience with prosecuting attorneys, is that they shouldn't be, but they usually would have no problems just flat out turning it over
And then each side would have the ability, for example, an officer may get up and say, I wrote down what they told me in English, they signed it. The other side would then have the opportunity to get the recorded statement to translate it, transcribe it, and then present it as well.
It seems that there may be a fiscal impact of the state public defender. As I understand it now, the law provides for the state public defender being responsible for costs associated with interpreters. But that's not the same as translators.
No, it's not.
Has the state public defender at all weighed in on this? Any idea? Question number one. Question number two, any idea what the financial impact may be on the state public defender's office since the proposed rule indicates that it is the moving party or the party requesting the admission that shall bear the responsibility for all costs of the translation?
I can assure you first that we've done everything we could to get comments from the important entities, including the Public Defender's Office. I can assure you as well that I don't have anything in writing from them. I can only represent that Carmel Capati, who's present with me today, got a thumbs up from the Public Defender's Office. Through Julie Rich.
Okay. We're going to play telephone at the end of all of them.
Thank you. So that's the best that I can tell you, but I want to assure you that everybody had the opportunity to respond in writing, and as you can see, some did indeed respond in writing. That, I think, answers the first part, and as to the second part, I don't know what it's going to mean. Obviously, there could be a fiscal impact, but as I said, and as Justice Ziegler noted, you know, circuit court judges do this all the time where there's questions of indigency. We make orders for investigators, for scientific testing, alternate testing. There is going to be a fiscal impact from time to time, but I can't tell you, I can't give you any definite amount or number, and I certainly can't speak for the public defender.
Well, and there is now.
There is
this not. Evidence is being translated, and someone's bearing the cost.
Correct, and someone is bearing the cost. Somewhere in a court out there, somewhere in the state, it's happening right now, even as we speak.
Other questions or comments? Justice Prosser?
I don't know quite how to pose this. I am supposed to participate in a moot court competition in which someone is allegedly libeled by computer language.
By computer language, okay.
The squiggles and things like that.
We can't hear you. I can't hear
you. I heard. Yeah. Somebody
what I'm
computer
I'd
language.
Like to hear it.
Language could include things other than Russian, Spanish, French, that sort of thing. Could that include things like computer, you know, what's
HTML? That's an old computer language.
Oh,
okay.
Thank you.
Computer language?
Yeah.
I haven't thought about that quite honestly, and it's a question that I never really considered. Hmm. I suppose that there are those out there, our 16-year-old kids, who can translate that as easily as somebody else who has a foreign language or other than English experience. But I don't know how to answer that.
Not the intent of this provision, though.
No.
Spoken foreign languages.
Or?
Well, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Pardon.
Are you limiting it to traditional language?
No, because certainly this could apply to sign language, I believe. For example, there could be a statement taken from somebody who uses sign language, and then a sign language interpreter could, or
transcribe what was represented by the person using the sign language, and there may be a dispute between parties as to what was meant by the person and what was understood by the other person. Certainly this would cover that situation.
Okay. Thank you, Judge Ramirez, and thank the committee for its work on these three important issues. Interpreters have been an important issue for the state court system for a long time, coming to the fore about 10 years ago. And 10 years ago, we had no certified interpreters. We didn't have any rules of ethics for interpreters, and a lot of good work has been done for access to justice, and these rules will further improve it. So thank you.
Much work has been done, much work needs to be done, and as Carmel pointed out, in one of the paintings there's an interpreter that is here. Mm-hmm. All right, thank you very much.
We remember that well, Judge. The other appearance is Andrew Chevres, representing the Wisconsin Hispanic Lawyers Association.
Good morning. May it please the court. Andrew Chevres. I'm representing the Wisconsin Hispanic Lawyers Association. This petition came to our attention rather late in the process. We have had some deliberations as far as the board of directors of the association. We have not yet formulated a position, and I guess I'm here to observe what the arguments are for the petition. I have had some communications with Judge Ramirez. I would request the opportunity to submit something in writing to the court. I'm not sure what the timeline is in terms of deciding this petition. If you could give us some time, that'd be good.
Ordinarily, Mr. Chevres, what we do is meet in open court in an administrative conference immediately after the hearing and try to make a decision about the petition. We might have to hold it over if we can't iron out issues with it. So the real issue is, in your own capacity, not representing the association, because you haven't had an opportunity to speak with them, I assume, do you see any problems here? I mean, doesn't my examination would indicate no big problems that can't be... There are no big problems. There are always small problems that arise because drafters don't see everything. This is not a major event. But you in the field can see it differently.
Sure. Well, we're interested because a lot of our members represent Spanish-speaking clients, of course. And I can tell you, if I'm to talk individually, I've been a participant in some of these discussions, and there is some concern that this may create some unintended consequences. Some of the language we believe could be tightened up.
Can you give us some examples of unintended consequences and how to tighten up the language?
Well, maybe not the unintended consequences, because we're trying to figure out what those what those are going to be. But I can give you examples of where it says a person knows English.
Where is that?
In 90108.
Pardon me?
90108 would be the second full sentence.
Okay. No 108. What does it say? No English.
Knows English.
No. Understands.
Yes.
The term knows English is not as precise as we would like it to be, because the fact that somebody knows English is not necessarily sufficient to maybe make the translation. And so that sentence there, in our opinion, could be more precise. I don't have that language for you because, as I said, I'm not prepared to take a position on behalf of the association. But there's also a concern as far procedurally.
You're talking about the translator knowing English.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's correct.
Well, what it doesn't say was that you not only know and understand English, but have a basic understanding of legal terms, but that's a little harder to do. Correct. Is that what your problem is?
Correct. That the translator be certified to conduct the translation, and that involves training, it involves...
Yeah, I know that. And this translator does not have to be a certified, doesn't have to be certified under our rules. We hope that everyone is using certified translator, but we know they're not because they're not available either for that language. We don't have certified translators for all languages. Well, they're not available in that area of the state. So your problem is not what it means by no English, but you're saying no the legal jargon.
Correct. The second issue is the procedural aspect. There may be a situation where you could have two challenges. One would be to the qualifications of the translator, and the other could be to the actual translation itself. And the first instance might be easily resolved without the need for a alternate translation.
Without what? I'm sorry.
Without the need for an alternate translation.
But the second
case. These things if raised during a trial could delay or impede the trial from going forward, We see that there could be possibly two types of tracks where it gives the court discretion to deal with the qualifications, and of course, you know, those qualifications could be contained in the affidavit.
Currently, counsel, Wisconsin has statute 887.26, if I recall, that deals with depositions taken outside of the state. And this language that you're referring to, that is the translator knows, I think comes right from that statute that says the translator shall append to all translations the translator's affidavit that the translator knows English and the language of the witness. That's 887.26(8). Does the language in the proposed rule, strike that, why would the language in the proposed rule cause problems that the current statute doesn't cause? I am assuming in my question that we don't have problems with that in 887.26. But maybe we do. But my question goes to is the language in the proposed rule, although it's the same, are the circumstances affecting how that language would play out?
I guess I haven't given this much thought. If the language is the same in
887.26(8), I think.
Right. Then I guess if this were the primary issue, then I would argue that perhaps that language needs to be tightened up as well. But I think that this proposed 901.8 has a broader application than the deposition.
Mm-hmm. That's really what I'm trying to drive at. I mean, there's something that says in my mind says, hey, listen, we've had this language for years, it hasn't caused problems, it's tried and true, so what's the problem here? That's the way that I at least initially look at it. And so is there any circumstances in terms of the breadth of application where problems would arise now that did not occur
in 887-26A.
Right. That is a much smaller world. I mean, you talk about depositions that normally would be taken in a civil type of setting, and then would be those taken outside of the state, so that's an even smaller subset.
Counsel, you started me thinking about unintended consequences, and so I'm hearing what you're saying. Under the current proposal, it seems that there's a safeguard. If you don't agree that this is a good or qualified translator, then you can go ahead and have someone who you believe is qualified translate, right? But there have also been occasions, I'm just thinking back on court experiences where someone comes in, defendant, initial appearance, there isn't a translator available, but their family member is sitting there, and they really just want to get through it, and they say, you know, this person understands me better than other people. I want them to sit next to me here and help me through this proceeding and whisper into my ear just to get me through today. I could see a group of facts under which someone would want their own person, certified or not, to create their translation of what they want the jury to know about, and you're tying their hands maybe by saying, nope, you have to have what I think is the right translator here, and I now am going to decide who will be able to do the translation. It's one thing when you're creating a court record and using certified translators so that the judge knows that there's a certified translator translating into the court record something that, you know, the rights that the person needs to understand or setting bond or whatever, or translating for purposes of court record what a witness is saying, or translating for purposes of a record what a witness said so a defendant understands it. But when you're talking about a proponent of evidence who wants to assert something before a jury and urge a jury to reach the conclusions they'd like the jury to reach, they may not want a certified person translating. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, it seems to me that might be a subject for cross-examination of the people who translate, but you might actually be tying someone's hands and forcing them to use a limited group of people when they would prefer not to. And you know, it goes beyond just Spanish-speaking or, foreign language-speaking people. I'm thinking back on a deaf individual I had in court who was deaf from the time he was born. And the translation to him in these proceedings was incredible because he had this very unique understanding of the English language and could communicate only in a very unique way. There were only two interpreters who were able to help us with that. And it was really difficult, really difficult. So if you needed someone who's certified, then, you know, you get into all these dialects and different, it's very difficult to find someone. So I'd urge you to think about that perhaps unintended consequence, because the last thing you want to do is tie someone's hands as to how they want to present their case in court. It's one thing to have a court record and have someone certified because you're saying that is the court record. It's another to have somebody in court saying you have to use these people that I say are approved, regardless of how you want to put forward your case. It just started me thinking down those lines when you were talking.
Right. I guess I don't want to take it too far upstream. I'm here representing the Wisconsin Hispanic Lawyer Association. We have not taken a position. Of course, I entertained the Chief Justice's request for my individual opinions, but
sure.
The general consensus is that we are supportive of the petition. The concept that the proponent should bear the cost of the translation, but as I said, there's just some minor language that we came across that we would do differently, but it may just be a stylistic issue.
Are there any other questions? Justice Prosser.
I understand that you talked with Judge Ramirez. And so this is sort of hearsay, a question I probably should have asked him. In preparing this, preparing 90108, do you know whether the laws of any other state were examined, according to him?
I have no
what?
I did not have that conversation with Judge Ramirez, so I can't. say. I've had some informal conversations with Judge Ramirez to try to understand what the committee's intent was. And it gets a little technical, so we've had some time to digest this, and unfortunately we ran out of time.
Well, it's not easy, and it's not easy to put in every concept. And even if you could agree on the concept, how to phrase it is not easy, too. Is it clear as to the procedure of when the party seeking to offer it pens all these translations and makes the motions? Or do you just have to rely on general procedure here?
My understanding is that there's no real specificity in terms of whether a hearing is required, what kind of, how that would take shape. And maybe that's better left to the discretion of the court.
As these issues arise.
Right.
Thank you very much. Are there any further questions? Well, we appreciate your spending your personal time and members of the association's time on these issues.
My pleasure.
Thank you, counsel. Anyone wishes to speak on 0903? Judge Ramirez, do you have anything you want to add? That you don't have to. Don't feel obliged, but you may.
No.
well, thank you.
Thank you,
Judge.
Could I ask
sorry.
A question?
The point was to give Judge Justice Prosser a chance to ask you a question. It's all right.
Is this the first time a provision of this nature has been passed in any state?
No, I have information from Texas and Arkansas, and just fairly quickly, for example, a Texas rule of evidence says that a translation of foreign language documents shall be admissible upon the affidavit of a qualified translator setting forth the qualifications of the translator and certifying that the translation is fair and accurate. Such affidavit, along with the translation and the underlying foreign language documents, shall be served upon all parties at least 45 days prior to the date of trial. So, no, it's not the first time, and this time I know I can point to Carmel with certainty. She's the one that gathered this evidence and was able to get information from other states. So our change complies, for example, with what Texas is doing, but it is correct. We don't have these time frames and these time limitations. Now, could we have added them and, you know, tried to have foreseen all possible situations in a criminal case, a civil case? Of course we could have. But I think that that's better left to the discretion of the court, taking into consideration all the other concepts and procedures that we have about discovery, undue delay, surprise at the time of trial, and so on. So there's other provisions that care for that, take care of that. So I think we've tried to do what we can.
Attorney Chevrez raised the issue that you could attack a translation at least on two grounds. One, the qualifications of the translator, and two, the substance that the translation is not appropriate, not correct. From what you read in Texas, the translator puts the qualifications into the affidavit. Should we do something like that?
Well, I think on its face that sounds like a very good idea, but I think Justice Ziegler brought up a very important thing. For example, we certify interpreters and translators that they can speak Spanish, the Spanish language. We don't say this person is an expert at a Mexican dialect,
right,
a Dominican dialect,
right,
or, you know, somewhere in the hills of Mexico, that dialect. And so I can see her point is well taken, I think, that there can be those situations where I may feel that I can have a better translation of what I said from somebody who's not certified, and of course that would be subject to challenge.
I didn't say certified. I state the qualifications. I am his brother-in-law.
Or I have experience in that dialect. I think that could be better. Yes.
So, would you object if the translator appends to the translations an affidavit of the qualification that he knows English or she knows English and the other language, the qualifications as a translator?
No, I have no objection to that.
And what else did the Texas law state?
It gave a time frame for challenges.
Yeah, well, I understand your objection to doing that because you don't have any other procedures set forth.
The affidavit along with the translations shall be served upon all parties at least 45 days prior, and it was to list qualifications and certifying that the translation is fair and accurate.
Yeah, we got the certification that it's accurate, but to state its qualifications as a translator. Okay. That might help what Mr. Shiver said about the qualification issue. Any other questions?
Yes.
Justice Bradley.
Judge, right now, to my knowledge, we have no certification, court-approved certification for translators, only for interpreters. Is that correct?
Correct.
I mean, is your knowledge the same as mine?
Correct.
Yeah, that's right. I remember a week or so ago I was in a conversation and I was using the term translator when I really meant the term interpreter. And so they're different.
Always do the same as well.
They're different things. Okay. Thank
you. I'm not suggesting the affidavit say he's certified in Wisconsin because he won't be or she won't be. But you could state your qualifications might be certified as a translator in another state. I don't know if that's being done. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you very much, Evan.
Does anyone else want to appear on 0903? Seeing no one and hearing from no one, I'm sorry. That's 903. I will close the hearing on 0903 in the matter of the petition to create 887-27, 90108, and 70.155 relating to the submission of evidence originating in a language other than English. I'm now going to move on to 0906 in the matter of the petition to amend Supreme Court Rule 10.041 to permit non-resident members to serve as certain officers of the State Bar of Wisconsin. The presenter is President of the State Bar, Douglas Kammer. Mr. Kammer.
May it please the Court. As is the habit, of course, I will offer only very brief comments, and then we have a couple of other people that will address the petition on the merits. First of all, because you have not yet responded to 0903, I will confine my comments to English.
Good.
And I want to make a prefatory remark also. The State Bar, as you probably are aware, is conducting a survey being run by the Strategic Planning Committee, asking every lawyer, including you seven, what you think of the integrated bar and the voluntary bar, and inviting an open-ended discussion. I invite all of you to participate. You can do so anonymously if you'd like. But where the idea and the object of the exercise is to hear from as many people as possible. Having said that, Judge, we are here presenting 0906. At a meeting in May, the Board of Governors voted to approve the filing of this petition by a vote of greater than 60%, as is required by our bylaws. The motion is based upon a recommendation from the Board of the Non-Resident Lawyers Division, at which they voted in May by a vote of 73 to request that the change be made. Our non-resident lawyers constitute almost a third of our membership, and I tell you this because I don't think it's involved in the petition, but certainly the people who present will be able to flesh this out if you have questions. Of those people that are non-resident lawyers, a tremendous percentage of them are very close to Madison. They're just across the line in Minnesota or just across the line in Illinois, many of them are much closer than our colleagues in Douglas County or Bayfield County, for example. And what they're asking is to have the right to stand in as officers for all offices except for president and president-elect. The two people that are going to speak to you on this are Attorney Wendy Calvert. She is acting president of the non-resident lawyers division, and Attorney Stephen Schuster, who's the past president. And unless you have questions of me, I'll yield the floor to them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kammer. The appearances I have noted now is Ms. Calvert and Mr. Schuster. Who wants to go first? Okay. Mr. Schuster.
Good morning. Good morning, Justices. I'm Steve Schuster. My day job is as an attorney for the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission in Washington. I'm here today in my role as the past president of the non-resident lawyers division, and I'm here to testify in favor of the petition for revision. I think that our petition is relatively straightforward. I'd just like to make a few points on the reasoning for asking for the revision of the rule. As President Kammer said, the current rule prohibits non-residents from holding officer positions within the state bar. The rule says that only active members currently residing and practicing in Wisconsin are eligible to serve as officers of the state bar, and the non-residents make up 31% of the members of the state bar. We've advocated, the non-residents and the Board of Governors has advocated the revision to the rule as a matter of general fairness. Non-residents pay dues equal to resident members and are currently prohibited from holding officer positions within the state bar. The non-resident lawyers division has not requested that president or president-elect be included in the revision by design, because we feel that those positions have numerous duties within the state, and it might be impractical for a non-resident to perform all those duties.
I have a question, Mr. Schuster. 1004(1)(c) says that the chairperson of the Board of Governors, who could be a non-resident, right, shall perform the duties of the president in the absence or disability of the president, or in the event of a vacancy. So, in effect, we hope this never occurs, within a week after the person takes office, and it's July or August, I always forget which month it is, they become disabled or deceased, and you have, in effect, for 11 months and 3 weeks, a non-resident doing an office that this petition recognizes they really cannot, not all the time, but most probably cannot fulfill. So do we have to do something about C?
Well, this was addressed at the non-resident board meeting, and it was also addressed at the Board of Governors meeting. And we felt that if your scenario would occur, the chair of the board would be filling in an acting capacity as president, not as president. So that was sort of our discussion. And
but technically you're right, but practically is that what the board wants?
Right.
Non-resident president.
I think that's true. I think it was discussed at the Board of Governors meeting, and it was we addressed it that it would be, hopefully, if it does occur, only for a short period of time. And I think the Board of Governors were comfortable with the act.
No one see. I just don't want it to remain as is, just because everybody forgot about it. I wanted a decision that you know about C, everyone knew about C, and the decision was let it alone.
Yes, it was discussed at the Board of Governors meeting, and there was no...
Let it alone. Okay.
No, it was a non-controversial provision. But we at the non-resident lawyers division, that board meeting, that was addressed, and so we are aware of the way that it's written.
But was the Board of Governors aware of it? Or just,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there were some questions as to that, whether it was inconsistent or not. One other point that I would like to make in favor of the rule is that in terms of non-residents attending state bar meetings, pursuant to rules 10.05 and 10.06, each year the president of the non-resident lawyers division is, by rule, a member of the state bar's executive committee and the Board of Governors, and attendance by non-residents at those meetings in Wisconsin has always been equal to the attendance by members in the state. So I don't think that if a non-resident held these positions that we're talking about, the duties are so onerous that they couldn't fulfill these duties. And I'll take it. I'm joined here today by the current president of the non-resident lawyers division, and she would address you, and then we'll take any questions.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And thank you for allowing us to come here today and speak on this matter. And thank you for consideration of our petition. I'm not going to really add that much more because I don't think there's that much more that needs to be added.
Just for the record, yes. How do you spell your name and where do you practice?
I'm sorry. My name is Wendy Calvert, and it's C-A-L-V as in Victor, E-R-T. And I am the current president of Non-Resident Lawyers Division, former Young Lawyers Division governor. And this is very important to us because we feel that the non-resident...
And where do you practice?
Oh, I'm practicing currently as a corporate lawyer with LexisNexis. And I reside in Chicago, Illinois. I'm formerly from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where I was born and raised and went to UW Law School. And
we forgive you for leaving the state.
Well, I'm always here because, you know, working diligently with this board has required me. Like Steve was saying, I'm here 8 times a year. So it's a commitment that I've chosen to make as part of a member of the non-resident lawyers, that this is important to me to be connected and to remain as part of what's going on with the state of Wisconsin. And I think that's going to be, you can see that with the commitment of many of our officers on the board, and I think it would be fair for us to be able to serve as a secretary or treasurer if someone wants to make that time commitment to do so. I think there's really no reason in the rules for them not to be able to do that. So we would respectfully request that you support our petition. Thank you. Have a nice day.
Any questions?
Ms. Calvert, I've got a question, if I might. When I was a new justice, I think the first or second year I was a justice, I went to Chicago and met with the Illinois group. It was a rather large group. I thought it was a very interesting meeting. Is that something that you do with regularity, that you invite members of this court to come and meet with you?
For the non-resident lawyer division, it has not been in the past. We would welcome.
Does that mean after Justice Crooks attended that they stopped?
I must have cut off the group. No, I thought it was very, very useful, and my recollection is that the president of the state bar was there as well, and there was a pretty good turnout. When I say a pretty good turnout, 25 or 30 lawyers. You've got a pretty active group, from what I remember, in Chicago. Isn't that correct?
Yes. Minnesota and then Chicago are the largest group of non-resident lawyers associated with the state of Wisconsin.
And how many do you have in Illinois?
There are about a little over 1,000, and I think there's about 1,200 to 1,300 in Minnesota. So we have a quite active chapter down in Chicago. There are two chapter presidents. They put together an event about, I want to say, 6 months ago with CLE and some other activities to bring the members of the State Bar of Wisconsin who are non-resident lawyers together to help with CLE credits and accreditation, as well as to social networking and things like that.
You have a chapter in the Washington, D.C. area also?
Yes, we do, and Steve is actually a member of that chapter. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Universities, law school, that is both Marquette, I think, and UW, and the State Bar have joined forces in other cities and communities outside Wisconsin and had events to promote interest in both the law schools and in the State Bar, which have been very successful.
And that's
you will continue it.
That's an excellent idea. We need
maybe
to
you should go abroad, too, and invite a justice and pay his or her way.
I'd be happy to go.
I knew I could get a volunteer. Say this joshingly, but many of us have family members outside the Wisconsin borders who have attended these events, and it does give them contact with the state and with the bar, even if they're not members of the bar yet, and with the increased availability of membership on foreign license, you might find increased membership of non-resident lawyers. So I think this is a significant petition.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments?
Thank you. Thank you. Does anyone else want to appear on in favor of or opposed to 0906? Permitting non-resident members to serve with certain officers. Mr. Kammer?
May it please the court. I'm appearing now just individually and not as president of the State Bar. Okay. I strongly support
you this. Look the same.
Didn't have time to change the suit yet. I strongly support this petition. I think it's a matter of fundamental fairness. These folks pay the same dues as everyone else. They're very diligent. They're active in bar functions. And they should be treated equally with everyone else. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kammer. Any other appearances? Hearing none, I will call the hearing on 0906 in the matter of the petition to amend SCR 10.041 to permit non-resident members to serve as certain offices of the State Bar of Wisconsin closed. That concludes our hearings this morning, and I'm going to have recess for lunch, and we'll come back at 1:30 to decide these petitions. And I sent an email this morning saying I was hoping that this would not take up the entire afternoon, and that we would go into closed conference and complete or at least attempt to complete outstanding matters on the closed conference. So 1:30, we return.